slowly to march.
No, just a minute. 5 to 1. Now, let me say, I mean, what I'm going to discuss today are elementary things. Actually, I'll deal with terminology, but in my opinion, halachic terminology is very important. And each term expresses an idea. And I'm going to deal with the terminology centered around Jewish holidays. And I'll try, I mean, to somehow to follow, I mean, the lead of the terminology and to analyze the very essence of Jewish holidays. It is a strange, what shall I say, paper. When I sat down to write, I had something else in mind. But the baby who came into this world is a different one. But I believe that you'll follow me and it will help you, I mean, in understanding the Jewish philosophy of holidays. When we speak of festivals, we must distinguish between two terms. One term is Yom Kadosh, or the way people in their halachic lingo say Gedushat HaYom. The difference is that Yom Kadosh is a Kadosh, an adjective. When you say Gedushat HaYom, is the Gedusha a substantive. But this is one group of holidays which can be described as Yom Kadosh, or Yamim Kedoshim, or those who possess Gedushat HaYom. There is another group of holidays which we call, or we classify, as Yom Tov, or Yomim Tovim. Both terms, that of Gedushat HaYom and that of Yom Tov, are of biblical origin. They are certainly of Talmudic origin as well. Gedushat HaYom, the whole concept of Gedushat HaYom, there are days which are endowed with holiness. Usually when we speak about days, I mean, we never think of something substantive, of something having a content, an essence, and what the philosophy is called essentia or substantia. To us, time is not something living. It's not a subject to which attributes can be ascribed and traits are actually predicated. To us, time is like, in the Kantian manner, is just, it is actually a mathematical concept, nothing else. I mean, now modern physics has combined time with space, so it is empty as space is. It is just one of the system. It's one coordinate of a system within which we try to explain the world, I mean, the cosmic dynamics. The Judaism time was something else, was some a living entity. Living entity, there was substance to time, there was individuality to time, there was essence to time, and you could ascribe attributes to time. The same manner as you do ascribe attributes to people. It's a nice person, good person, handsome person, a holy person, or an evil person. You can also speak of time. Holy time, holy day, an evil day, a sad day. We actually, as a matter of fact, in our colloquial, we use in all languages, even in English, in German, in any language, an evil day. But while, I mean, modern man thinks that an evil day means a day on which evil, somehow an evil event took place. When you had to say, it means the day itself is evil, the day itself is cursed. And the same applies to positive attributes. And when you say a holiday, it means the day itself is holy. Not a day on which man somehow experiences holiness. Now this is already rationalization. When we approach the others, we should many times try to understand the others in its own categories. Whether they appear fashionable to us or perhaps old-fashioned, it's completely irrelevant. We have to understand the others in its unique, singular categories. And time in Yahadus is something substantive, something essential. It is individuality. I would even say it's a personality. It is not just a part of a coordinate, of a mathematical coordinate system. So hence, the pasuk says, "Vayvorech Elokim es Yom Hashvi'i, Vayikadesh Eisei." God has blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. In Nehemiah, we find that on Rosh Hashanah and Ezra recited the law, and the people cried. So the Alvi Yimach Shimboam, and the Levites tried to silence the people, that saying that it is forbidden to cry on Rosh Hashanah, but they described the day, the character of the day, Ki Kodosh Hayom Ladenenu. The day is holy and dedicated to God. The term Yom Tov is also mentioned in the Bible, namely, where Yom Tov in the Bible, where? In Megillah, correct. In the scroll of Esther. Eisim es Yom Arbu Asar v'chedesh Ador Simcha u'mishte v'yom Tov. Of course, we in our halachic lingo use both terms continually. Sometimes we speak about Kedushas Hayom, sometimes we speak about Yom Tov. Quite often you don't discriminate between these two terms. Remarkable is one detail. While we apply the epithet of Yom Tov to all holidays without any discrimination, we will call Pesach Yom Tov, we will call Shavuos Yom Tov, Rosh Hashanah Yom Tov, even Yom Kippur we call Yom Tov. Sukkot. We have never said about Shabbos that it's a Yom Tov. Never. Shabbos the Yom Tov, I mean, you know. It's two extremes, two poles. And man somehow swings like a pendulum between those two poles. But you have never found, you've never come across in our halachic literature or in the Bible, I mean, or in any kind, in any commentary, that Shabbos be called and termed Yom Tov. Apparently Shabbos is not Yom Tov. Why? But anyway, we have been dealing now with Kedushat Hayom, with Yomim Kedoshim. But for instance, Chanukah Purim are Yomim Tovim, no doubt about it. Yet they do not possess Kedushat Hayom. They are not Yomim Kedoshim. Concerning Purim, we have already pointed out the description of the day as Yom Tov is mentioned in the Megillah. As regards Hanukkah, and of course Hanukkah is not mentioned in Kisva Kedesh. There is no Megillah's Hanukkah in Kisva Kedesh. So we have to simply refer to Megillas Ta'anit. Megillas Ta'anit, quoted by the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Chafalef, I believe, Amit Beis. The Braise states, Leshona Abo, Osem Yom Tov, Behalel Veidoe, or Besimche Vehalel. So the name Yom Tov is applicable to Hanukkah too. However, as we mentioned, they lack Gdusha Sayyid. While Shabbos and Gimel Regolim or Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are Yomim Kedoshim, Chanukah and Purim are Yimei Chol. Now let me ask a simple question. What does Gdusha Sayyid mean? What is it actually? Correct. When we say that the day is holy, Ki Kodesh Hayim Ladineinu, what does it mean in halachic terms? What do Sayyid means at the very outset is simply Gdusha Sayyim denotes or signifies an inner endowment, as I told you before. Or shall I say, it is now it has become a colloquial term, a charisma, enmeshed or hidden in the very substance or essence of the day. And this charisma, this inner quality, it's a mysterious quality, which is hidden in the very essence of the day, expresses itself halachically, as it was said before, in Iso Meloche, prohibition against work. Chanukah Purim do not precipitate Iso Meloche. Apparently they lack that specific endowment which usually expresses itself in Iso Meloche. Wherever there is no Iso Meloche, one cannot speak of Gdusha Sayyid. The latter is inseparable from the idea of absolute rest, but not so much rest as absolute cessation or complete stoppage, discontinuation. It's easy to say that the Gdusha Sayyim expresses itself in Iso Meloche. Could somebody prove it by quoting a text? We say to Retzei in Birkas Hamozon, Ki yom ze godel ve kodesh lishbos bei velo nuar bei behavo ki mitzvas retzinecho. For this is a great and holy day dedicated lishbos bei, to cessation or discontinuation and to rest, of course with love, in accordance with thy will. The adjectives Godel the Kodesh are inseparably linked up with Shviso and Menucha, and there is no doubt that Shviso is by far a more important attribute of the day than Menucha. Living off and resting. And let's not forget that the term Gdusha, quite often in the Bible, has the connotation of separateness, of being separate. Or it has the meaning of being not common, or a meaning of uncommonness, singularity, distinctiveness. As a matter of fact, the term Kodesh also has the connotation of distance, of being remote, being far, far away. When you say Kadosh, 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 Avaya Tzvoya, Melech Olorets Kvede. So we indicate this great paradox in our religious experience, that on the one hand we experience God as remote, as distant, as abiding in infinity, in the recesses of transcendence, and on the other hand, God is my companion, right here. Kadosh, 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 remote, exalted, above and beyond everything, above and beyond the cosmos, the great, the unity, the boundless universe, and at the same time, Melech Olorat Kvede, I mean, he fills out the universe, and he's right here near me. That's why in Chabad, the two terms, Memale Kol Almin, the Seviv Kol Almin, are so important. So basically, Kedusha means many times distance, remoteness, being unreachable. Therefore, when we say Shabbosis V'yom Tevim, that have been set aside as days of rest and discontinuation, or leaving off, or cessation, are not ordinary common days. Whoever possesses Kedusha is not, cannot be a common entity, cannot be a common person. There is something unique about him, something singular, something different. So if Shabbosis V'yom Tevim are endowed with Kedusha, it means they are endowed with uniqueness. They are many times remote from the ordinary way of life, or from ordinary days. They are not ordinary, they are not common days. They are what shall I use the term, they are freaks. They are different. You know very well. Sometimes we may admire a freak, and sometimes he's very annoying. A freak can be very annoying. So Shabbos Yontif can be terribly annoying. Annoying and interfering with our everyday conveniences and little pleasures. It's exactly the, what shall I say? This reflects exactly Kedusha. Even Yehadus as such is sometimes very annoying and very unwelcome to the ordinary man. They are unusual days. What happens on that day? Nothing in particular. Just the workaday routine is interrupted on that day. What happens on that day? The established program of human activities. What is that program? What does that, where is this program mentioned in the Bible? Human being has a certain routine, a certain program. This program has not changed. This program has not changed over the centuries and millennia. It's the same. The program, in my opinion, you will find, yes, correct. I believe it's beautifully described in Bocha Nafshi. Tizra Hashemesh, Hashemesh Yer Yisofun, Vel Mei Nosom Yer Botzum. The sun rises, they slink away, the young lions, and they hide in their dens. Man goes forth unto his work and to his labor until the evening. That routine of Yizrach HaShemesh, and that monotony is discontinued if the yom is not an ordinary day, but a yom gadol v'kadosh, a great day and a holy day. Of course, even on a yom gadol v'kadosh, the sun rises, the universe is not different. Certainly the young lions couch in their dens and Ayim Gadol V'Kadosh, but man does not go forth unto his work or to his labor. No. Today, man has a different, a unique schedule. What the schedule is, we don't know. This distinctiveness, as far as the schedule is concerned, the change sanctifies and hallows the day and makes it a Yom Gadol VeKadosh. Why is it a Yom Gadol VeKadosh? Because it is a unique day. The question arises, what is the nature and the essence not of a Yom Gadol VeKadosh, but of Yom Tov? That is deprived of Kedushas Hayom. Chanukah Purim are deprived of this Hayom. They are stripped of this Hayom. Meloch is permissible. On the one hand, the day of Chanukah or Purim, it does not differ from an ordinary way, from the ordinary day. On Chanukah Purim, man goes forth to his work and to his labor until the evening. On the other hand, man is called to act or to engage in specific action which the Halacha calls mitzvah sayim on those days. For example, Purim, a man is obligated to recite the Megillah, and Chanukah to light the candles, to say Hallel, to abstain from Hesped Vetanis, from grief, from fasting, and public mourning. The conclusion is obvious. Even Chanukah and Purim are endowed with some charisma, with some singular quality not to be found in an ordinary day. Of course, they are not Yom Kedishim. Here they are, and this is my term, Yomim Tovim, of course, but I would say Yomim Kvuim. They've been singled out. Or Yomim Tmufchorim. They've been selected out of 365 days. 8 days of Chanukah and 1 or 2 days of Purim have been selected and set apart. And they are also different. There is somehow individuality. There is character to them. What is obvious? That they are not ordinary days. So if this be so, so the question rises, what is the difference between Yomim Kedeshim or Yomim Tovim, or rather not to, because to avoid confusion, I'll call it Yomim Kvuim or Yomim Mufchorim. What's the difference? Of course, the halachic answer is clear. Yomim Kedeshim are workless days. Yomim Kvuim are work days. Yet one asks, what is the root of this distinction? Because apparently there is a different experience related to Yomim Kedeshim than the experience which is associated with Yomim Kvuim, like Chanukah Purim. The answer that Yom Kedeshim are all midrashic, biblical origin, and Yom Kvuim are of rabbinic origin, I mean, would not satisfy us. Let me give you the answer in one sentence, and then I'll elaborate this sentence. That's exactly what the paper is out to accomplish. The answer, I believe, is as follows. The idea of Yom Kedeshim, or the charisma of Yom Kedeshim, expresses itself in human, what shall I say, introspection or withdrawal. the experience of Yomim Gedeshim, of Yomim Kvuyim, manifests itself in human openness and outer directedness. I'll elaborate that. Let me explain it. Wherever the Torah spoke of Shabbos, not only of Shabbos, of the three holidays as well, namely Kippur Golim, Rosh Hashanah, Purim, and Erech Shana, Pesach, Shavuos, and Regolim, as well as Rosh Hashanah. Wherever the Torah spoke of Shabbos or other holidays, it never failed to mention that the day, the charismatic or holy day, not holiday, but the holy day is related and dedicated to the Lord, to the Almighty. The Yom HaShvi'i Shabbat L'Adishem Melekecho. Sheis Yom Tavid V'sisa Kol Melachtecho. The Yom HaShvi'i Shabbos L'Adishem Melekecho. The seventh day is a Sabbath unto the Lord. Chag HaSukkis Tasaloch. Shivas Yomim Tochek L'Adishem Melekecho. The Feast of Sukkot. You'll observe the Feast of Sukkot. And you'll celebrate 7 days unto the Lord. Chag Shavuos Taseh L'Adishem Melekecho. The Feast of Weeks you'll celebrate unto the Lord. What does it mean? What does it mean? The word L'Adishem Melekecho. What do the words "the seventh day is a Sabbath unto the Lord" mean? What idea hides behind those strange, enigmatic words? Unto the Lord thy God. Should it? It would have been sufficient if he had said, Sheishes Yom Tavod Vesisa Kol Malachtecho V'yeim HaShvi'i Shabbat. The idea would have been conveyed to us, the 6 days we are allowed to work, and the seventh day we have to cease to work. I believe that those enigmatic words express an exalted idea in Yahadus. I would say it is the idea which was mentioned by the Eitz HaChaim, the Ari, the founder of the Lurianic school in mysticism, and later developed and made the central idea of Chabad by the Tanya, by the founder of Chabad. The idea is what is known, whoever studied it, as Soda Tzimtzum, the mystery of self-contraction, or the mystery of self-limitation, or the mystery of self-restriction, or the mystery of withdrawal and retreat. As a matter of fact, this mystery has stimulated also the controversy between Chassidim and Mesnagdim. If we consider this controversy from a philosophical viewpoint, what does this mystery of Tzimtzum say? Let me explain it in very simple terms. The mystery of Tzimtzum says that creation of the world is a sacrificial act on the part of the Almighty. As if, Kaviochen, the Almighty has brought a sacrifice. He gave something up when he said, Yehi Eir, let there be light. Or, by saying Yehi Eir, the Almighty meant, let there be a world. Before the universe came into existence, God was one, His name was one. By creating a world in general, and by creating men in particular, God had surrendered. His aloneness of being alone and his loneliness, again, being alone to the world. In order to create a world, he allowed finiteness, in this case a physical world, a physical universe, to share in his infinite being, in his infinite existence. He allowed somebody else or something else to share with him in what was exclusively his own. Prior to creation, there was only one infinite, all-inclusive, and all-encompassing, and all-embracing existence, God. There was nothing beside him. God had kaviyochel to withdraw and to contract himself in order to permit a world that, in order to permit a world to be born out of nothingness. Yetzire means an act of self-restricting on the part of infinity and permitting finitude to exist beside infinity. Something which is nonsensical from the viewpoint of logic. From the viewpoint of logic, you all know that if you take an infinite number, you try to add a finite number to the infinite number, what will you get in some total? An infinite number. So basically the whole existence of the world is an absurdity from one viewpoint. It's nonsensical. You don't exist. But how can finitude exist beside infinity? It's mathematically wrong. It's logically wrong. And this absurdity is responsible for our existence, that the world came into existence. This is the great mystery of Tzimtzum. I cannot develop it, I mean, fully. In accordance with the Lurianic doctrine, which was developed, I mean, later by the founder of Chabad. It is true that in particular, the creation of man in God's image was a sacrificial act on the part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The mere fact that he endowed man with imago Dei, with the image, with his image, it is itself already an act of giving up. Because there is somebody who is divine. And he endowed man not only with the image, but he endowed both with great talent, with extraordinary capabilities, with numerous skills God bestowed upon him, honor and glory which belong exclusively to God. It's very interesting. Chassidim do it every Shabbos, but in my opinion it is more impressive. The custom of Misnagdim is by far more impressive. We say it only once a year. That's what I'm referring to. Oderes v'amuno lechei elamin. Abino v'abrocho lechei elamin. Ahed v'ahodo lechei elamin. I mean, all those attributes actually still belong exclusively to God. But God in his generosity has bestowed some of the attributes on man. Man is a productive, indeed is a creative being. God allowed man to consider himself master and lord of his environment. Tail shatter tachas raglov. He put everything under his feet. God was generous with man. He even urged man to explore the universe. And he advised him to reach out even for the boundless and the fantastic, even for that which is unreachable. And man, regretfully, many times is mistaken. He actually looks upon himself as if he were a creator, as if he indeed owned everything, himself and the world. What we call in Kabbalah the Nochash HaKadmeni, the serpent of old, or the ancient serpent, the ancient serpent of Genesis, suggested to man that he may conquer the world and crown himself as God. God tolerated. God does not take away man's skills, man's talents, man's capabilities, even though from time to time man misuses them. He becomes arrogant and also very foolish. On the Sabbath and on every Yom Gadol V'Kadosh, when a great day and a holy day arrives, man is called upon to cease, not to rest. Rest is the result. But he is called upon to cease. What should he cease? What activity? What activity should he cease? To play the role of master and lord. To acknowledge that he possesses nothing, owes nothing, masters nothing, and he is nothing. That he is not in control, certainly that he is neither in control of the world, nor is he in control of himself, or of his own talents and skills. Yom Kadosh is not so much a day of rest, of menucha. It is mainly a day of shvisa, of stopping, discontinuing, giving up. While menucha denotes rest, shvisa has the connotation of leaving off, of discontinuing. Something which one is accustomed to. What is this something? What is this something? No, this is already this is work. Why was work chosen as the means of man's humbling himself and admitting the truth and, so to say, and pleading guilty of arrogance, of false pretenses, of an over-exaggerated notion of himself? Why was work chosen by the Torah as the symbol of that basic change in man which should take place on the Yom Gadol V'Kadosh? For two reasons. Work basically is important for two reasons. Work is the source of human power and glory. No other creature is basically a working being, a working creature. No other creature is capable of constructing work. If the animal sometimes is busy, whatever the animal does is not work in a philosophical sense. It is pushed by some mechanical instinct. There is no intention, there is no plan, and there is no productivity. There is no productivity. An animal doesn't produce. It certainly, there is no creativity. An animal doesn't create. Only man is a working being. I understand by that. A productive being. And through work, and only through work, man manifests his unlimited power. It's just a bit below the angels. The reason is because man has capacity for work. When, for instance, the Greek mythology, and it spilled over into Greek philosophy, into Plato's ideal republic, considered work as a degrading occupation for man. On the contrary, they always dreamt of the golden age, or an existence which would not require work of man, because work was just good for slaves. Don't forget the Greeks had a slave society, but for the freemen, for the Hellen, for the Hellenistic race, work is degrading, it's below the dignity. Yahadus came out, the first one, that work is dignifying, redeeming, cleansing. Who works? Even Kaviyochel God. We call Melachti Asher Asom. And if man wants to reach dignity, greatness, sweep, and depth, there is only one means which he can employ. This is work. We work, there's another aspect to work. Work is the cohesive force which unites individuals into a group. Sociologically very important. Work is the most potent factor which pulls man out of his hideout, of his hiding, and merges individuals into communities. And for simple reason here. Everybody knows it. One cannot acquire all skills which are indispensable for the gratification of man's needs. And therefore, one must exchange One must exchange services with his contemporaries. The exchange of services brings about interdependence, an interaction which in turn lead to fraternization or to the coalescence of individuals into one entity. Call it community, call it society, call it state. I mean, the name is completely irrelevant. The constant trading and exchanging interweaves the individual into a community, and the isolated I into the texture of a together existence or an existence in community. The constant trading and exchanging interweaves the individual into community and the isolated I into the texture of a together existence or an existence in community. In short, the role which work plays in promoting a together existence or a community existence is tremendous. If people didn't have to work, if people didn't work, they would never form a community or a state. They would never coalesce and unite into groups, because each individual would feel happy in his isolation and in his place of hiding. There wouldn't have been, this magnetic force which pulls the individual toward the community. As a matter of fact, here Yahadus again is in conflict with the philosophy of the Age of Reason. The philosophy of the Age of Reason adored the individual, did not understand the community. In explaining the community, they had to introduce a new concept, like the social contract, which is very artificial and very synthetic. Because to Rousseau, Montesquieu, Voltaire, all the philosophers of the Age of Reason, basically the individual is the great being, not the communities. That's why such a story, the story of Robinson Crusoe, was born during the Age of Reason. It couldn't have been born now with Marxism rampant and communism, expanding quickly, because in Marxism the individual means nothing, the community reigns supreme. Yadus has never agreed with this theory that the individual can get along all by himself, alone, on an island. Yadus was of the opinion that lonely man cannot meet the task that has been assigned to him by his creator. What task has been assigned to man by his creator? Leovdo leshomro, to dress and to keep, to work and to cut and to cultivate. Working man, if man cannot afford to be idle, but has got to be a working being, so he needs a helper. It's not good for men to be alone. I shall make a helper opposite him. In short, the working man is always what we call it in halachic literature, in Rishus HaRabim. He's on the highway. Manufacturing, trading, exchanging goods and services, talking, arguing, fighting, helping. But always be somebody. No wonder that Chava was created the very instant Adam was charged with the task of Leovdo Leshomro. He was placed in the Garden of Eden, charged with the task of Leovdo Leshomro, to be a working being, and also, and as a working being, he needed help. So Eve was created. No wonder, I see it every day. Perhaps that's the reason that time's still active, that people who retire from business or from professions find out, and quite quickly, very fast, that they are unneeded, lonely, and that society abandoned them, including their own children, and that the world passes them by. Because if a man stops working, there is no need for him to maintain communication lines with the community, with the society. Somehow he expels himself. He expels himself. He excludes himself from the working community. If there is no work, there are no responsibilities, the communal ties, little by little, disappear, are broken. And on the Sabbath, God told man to stop working. What did he want to achieve by that? What was God out to achieve by telling man to stop working? He told man to cease to work, leave off in the middle, retreat, and rest. In other words, man is supposed, but I want you not to misunderstand me, on Shabbos to leave society. Men retreats, using a Buber term, from the Tao existence, means I am Tao existence, into an I existence. He retreats on the Sabbath, this is the experience of the Sabbath, into privacy and aloneness. On the Sabbath, the individual gains supremacy over the community. He withdraws from conquest and acquisition, from work, and if he withdraws from conquest and acquisition and work, then he also withdraws from his co-workers and partners and associates into the mysterious abode of a lonely I existence. It's quite remarkable that in Bishalach, when Moses revealed on behalf of the Almighty the mystery of Shabbos to the people, so the slogan of Shabbos became Al Yetzei Shvu Tachtachem, sit, stay in your places. Al yetze ish min keimei ba yom ha-shvi. No man go out at his place on the seventh day. No fraternization. No unitedness, I would say. No coalescence. Man is alone. And he should experience himself as a being alone. On the Sabbath, God tolerates no competition. He does not want to share man with anybody else, with society. Hence, he told man retreat from society. The latter has no claims on thee. The Yom HaShvi, now we understand the words, the Yom HaShvi Shabbat L'Hashem Elokecha. The seventh day is up to the Lord. The seventh day is the Sabbath unto thy God. Everything belongs to him. Cease to be a slave to thy work. Discontinue being a servant to society. Be exclusively mine. And Sabbath, the idea of Sabbath, is man's aloneness. If man is alone, he is with God. The Kedushat HaShabbat, the charisma of Shabbos, expresses itself in the return of man to God and to himself. In the severance of the individual from the working society, that's act of severing, hallows the day and renders it a Yom Godel V'Kodesh. Separation from society is ipso facto liberation from society. Man terminates his transient relations with his fellow man and establishes another relation which is permanent, communion with God. Don't ask me any questions about it. Of course, people do a lot of visiting on Shabbos. And the impression which is conveyed as if Shabbos were a day of socializing, of fraternizing, of being together. It's not true. Perhaps I'll explain to you later in what there is only one exception to the rule which the Torah made of men being alone on Shabbos, and that's as far as study is concerned. If I have time, I'll explain. However, let's continue. However, Judaism thought, here we come to the dialectical nature of Judaic approach. However, Judaism thought highly of existence in community as well. God is not only the father of the individuals, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, but of the community as an entity. He's Elokei Yisrael as well. Judaism's approach to the problem of, millennia-old problem, which came up in the Greek, pre-Socratic Greek philosophy, the problem of individual versus community. Let me use a Talmudic phrase, heiminayodif, which is to do preferred, an individual existence or a communal existence. The approach of Judaism was one of dialectics, a dialectical approach. Namely, Judaism has accepted, as in many other places, as many other cases, accepted the thesis as well as the antithesis. Judaism says as following about this problem. On the one hand, if man is completely united with the community, only Rishus HaRabim, immersed in the concerns of the many, and not paying attention to his own needs or to himself. I don't mean in a selfish manner, in an egotistic manner. He is liable to lose his very power, his very humanity, his original thrust and sensitivity, the fantastic resources of human creativity are, and I'm convinced about it, to be found not in public man, but in private man. Not in man's communion with others, but in man's communion with himself. The greatness, the genius in man is to be discovered in a monologue, not in the dialogue between man, between the I and the thou. The greatness is found in the soliloquy, not in chit-chat. In his loneliness awareness and sense of singleness, being single. I don't mean single not married. I mean single that no one else is like me. This is basic. Chazal developed it. Chazal did not believe in doubles as far as the countenance is concerned, as the face is concerned. He also believed that man is a, each man, each individual is a freak, as spiritually. He has his own unique approach, his own unique outlook on life, his own unique philosophy. If two people agree, it's because they compromise, they give up. Because if men were stubborn and truthful to himself, there would be a bellum homines contra homines, as Hobbes said, war of everybody against everybody. There is an element of sheker, of untruth, in human agreement, in agreement with two individuals. Of course, this means carrying the theory of individualism to an extreme. But I'm convinced that the greatness of man is to be found in Reshus HaYochid, in the four cubits of his individualistic, lonely existence. The corporate state, the socialist or communist society, tries hard to level off the distinctiveness of the individual. By so trying, the Marxist or communist society destroys the very sensitivity and creativity of man. It's a fact. For instance, Russia was famous for its literature. Russian literature, actually, the 19th century, I believe, as perhaps was the most profound and the most sensitive literature. It transcended the French and certainly the Germans as far as the novel is concerned. I'm not speaking about poetry, as far as the novel is concerned. It dried up. This literature dried up with the advent of communism in Russia. And don't tell me because the Russians don't allow even the books which were printed, I mean published in the abroad, outside of Russia, are not great artistic works. I mean, one got the Nobel Prize for it. It was purely for political reasons. The Kremlin was right as far as the Nobel Prize was concerned. Couldn't compare that with Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, or to Genev. I mean, you couldn't compare. There's no sweep. There's no depth to it. It lacks the mysterious quality, which Russian literature has. Because the corporate state cannot produce sensitive souls. Of course, you pay the toll of the road The artist is the first one to pay the toll of the road. Then comes the scientist. But the artist, in a corporate state, pays the toll of the road. Not because the state is not liberal enough. Simply, the resources of creativity dry up. They are to be found only in individual who rebels against society, individual who has the guts to say to society what he thinks, an individual who is introspective, an individual who tries to find out who he is. And since the mere question, who am I, is forbidden in Russia, is heresy, so if you don't answer the question, who am I, so there is no need for literature. Because all literature is concerned with one question. Since Homer and, what shall I say, and, about what the human being is, who he is, and particularly who am I, and what do I stand for. Yahadus encouraged man to rebel quite often against society, to act like an individual, and to be different and unique. No one who didn't study halacha properly has any idea, can imagine, how much freedom the halachic scholar has in interpreting halacha, in so-called chidushim, in being creative in the halachic field. Yehadus has encouraged. I mean, the famous story of Rabbi Lezer, he was in controversy with his colleagues, and they stood up, and they counted and accepted, I mean, the opinion of the majority. And then, I mean, there was intervention on part, or even on part of the Almighty, in favor of Rabbi Lezer, and he did not accept this intervention. Shows how much freedom the halachic scholar has. Of course, if he's a scholar, I want you to know. Those who claim freedom and say the halacha is not free are not scholars. This is the trouble. But a scholar enjoys unlimited freedom because the individual is the creative agent in halacha, as well as in any other field. And that's why you cannot limit his freedom, I mean, his authority to express opinions, I mean, the way he understands. God created just one man, Adam. He concluded his covenant just with one individual, Abraham. The first Redeemer was a lonely individual, Moses, and very strange. And while the tablets given to the entire community the first time were quickly shattered, the second Luchot, the second tablets, entrusted to Moses alone as an individual, no one could accompany Moses up the mount, are still existent. And we still are committed to them. That means Yahadus understood very well the greatness of the individual. And in order to be creative, he should not be completely enmeshed in society. On the other hand, Yahadus said, complete immersion in oneself leads to serious emotional problems. I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't tell you what kind of problems there are. I know there are problems. And egocentricity is not only immoral, but also a personalistic anomaly. And that's why to say the individual reigns supreme is impossible. This was the thesis. Now I'm trying to develop the antithesis. Moreover, the basic virtues, which are at the apex of our ethical hierarchy, like compassion, love, sharing in one's travail and distress, those basic virtues derived from the Midas HaChesed, from Chesed, will lose their significance should the individual live in isolation. Robinson Crusoe could not practice compassion. He had no one to sympathize with. He could not love anybody. He could love only one person, himself. How can the individual who withdrew from society experience compassion and love for his fellow man? How can the individual love his fellow man if he is emotionally remote from him? And such an individual is portrayed in the Bible. Well, some individual was punished, and then when he learned how to live in community, he was restored to his own glory, to his previous glory. Who? Joe. Just a moment. What kind of a fellow was Job? Chazal were never sure about him. It's a very elusive character, Job. Chazal were not too sure. They didn't even know when he existed, when he lived. One said he lived during the time of Abraham. Another one said during the time of Moses. Another one said he lived during the time of David. The fourth one said he lived during the time of Mordechai Esther. Anyway, I don't know when he lived. But he didn't leave any marks. He disappeared tracelessly, Job. And he did not, when Abraham was engaged in a struggle, Chazal speak about Abraham as the lonely person, the whole world on one side of the river, and he on the other side of the river. It's quite characteristic of Israel now. Yeah. But anyway, Abraham could use, the help and assistance of such a powerful man as Job. Did Job help him? No, not at all. He was not concerned. The same Moses could have used him too. According to one interpretation, he was a member of the inner council of the chicken cabinet, of the kitchen cabinet, of the... of the kitchen cabinet. It is a chicken cabinet, the kitchen cabinet. of that California cabinet, you see, which has decided the destiny of the Jew in Mitzrayim. Kolabina Yileda Yero Tashlechu. What did he, Bilam, was the advocate, the devil, he had recommended Kolabina Yileda Yero Tashlechu. Yisro opposed this opinion. It's a little too primitive. No, primitive, you don't do such things. You don't murder people. At least Yisro had a more sensitive conscience than the statesmen of today. Yeah, well, let murderers who killed 35, 36 people, go for you. It has never happened in not in our history, but in the history of the world. Yes. And what did Eve do? Job, Shosach, kept quiet. Well, then he was with Mimotchai Vester, Beshushan Abiyo, he could have protested against such an edict that was issued by Haman. Why, for what? Did he protest? No. He was an individualist. What did he do? With what was he concerned? How did he spend his life? What troubled his mind? Whom did he love? He loved somebody, himself and his family. And the Pasuk tells us in the most beautiful manner, in the most beautiful manner. And it was so when the days of their feasting were gone every week, the Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burning offerings according to the number of them all. It means it is seven. Beyond the number seven, no one else existed for Job. A Jewish people didn't exist. He forgot about it. That's why he met with disaster. It is quite characteristic that when God rewarded Job and gave him everything back, he stipulated one condition. Job will find everything he lost. In fact, he will get He met with disaster. It is quite characteristic that when God rewarded Job and gave him everything back, he stipulated one condition. Job will find everything he lost. In fact, he'll get twice as much. Provided he'll do just one thing. Bilat Ashuchi and Eliphaz HaTemoni and Sefer HaNamosi were in trouble, because he did not handle Job properly. And God said that he'll forgive their sins, provided Job will pray for them. But Job has never prayed for anyone else, but for himself and his children. How can Job pray for somebody else? Well, he could perhaps come to Shul HaShabbos and make a Mishaberach. The way we do sometimes. Yeah, but a Mishaberach was not enough. And God said, V'yispalel be'atchem, he meant real tefillah, genuine prayer, genuine intercession. But this was a conditio sine qua non. And apparently Job rose to great height after he met with disaster. And he found in himself enough love and enough concern for others and enough dedication that he indeed prayed for them. And the Pasuk tells us, and this is the whole moral of the book of Job, and the Lord changed the fortune of Job when he prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much. A single existence is quite often very dangerous. It may lead to the disaster of Job. It led to disaster, the single existence of the American Jewish community during the Holocaust plague. We are also concerned with ourselves. We are not concerned with the world, certainly not with our brethren, with our fellow Jews. And we let millions of Jews go down the drain. Somebody told me, and he's right, that to the least of our chet, of the Chatoim, we enumerate on Yom Kippur, we should add another Al-Chet. Perhaps it would be the worst, the most horrible one. Al-Chet Shechotonu Lefanecha. Beroyinu Tzoras Nafshesein Shalachinu. Shalachinu Beis Yisroel Shishanenu Aleinu V'leishamanu. I raise the question because I don't want to say it. I'm afraid we are about to confront the world again. Not. You know what I mean. We are isolated, completely alone. The whole world is against us, be it because of the shortage of oil, be it because man is unreliable. Kolodom Kesef, I don't know. I'll tell you frankly, I can't understand, I mean, the leaders of the world today. And they're going to sell out, I'm afraid so. I'm not an alarmist by nature. But if they're going to sell out, it will be a problem for the American Jews, how to act. And I don't recommend any course of action. I don't know yet what's going to happen. But I believe that every American Jew should have this possibility in mind. How do they act? Like Job? Before he met this disaster? We are safe here. a star. Of course, as far as human beings are concerned, you can never say safe. Support, I don't mean support to give some money, but more than that is involved. I don't know, I don't advise, I don't suggest, I don't give. I'm just reminding you. This is the problem. Hence, Judaism on the one hand understood the greatness of the existential experience of man alone. It's important to be an individual. But I told you, man is creative because he is an individual, because he is different, because he can be alone. He can live in the recesses of his personality, unknown to others. And on the other hand, Judaism also understood the greatness of the community, of the existential experience of living in the community or with the community. And Yahadu said, the thesis plus the antithesis are correct. Individual, the Jew must be capable of being alone and at the same time being together. Of withdrawing from society, escaping from society, from the noise of the street, from the vulgarity, from the coarseness of society, from the artificiality of society, and also must be capable to come back and join society, emerge in society, and be one in society. The Jew should experience existence as a together affair, as well as an only I affair. The Jew should know the art of being concerned only with himself, and also at the same time of being concerned with all, with the community. The individual is both a separate existential entity who cannot imagine existence outside of himself. Let me be, you know, when man gets older, he begins to think in very strange, peculiar terms. Once I can imagine many things, I cannot imagine one thing. And this is because I am an individual. What the world, how is it possible for the world? Will it be possible world to go on existing after I'll be gone? Cannot imagine that. I can't imagine it. There is a short story written by an Austrian writer. Peter Altenberg was a Jew, simulated Jew. He was at the turn of the century. He fought against Herzl, because Herzl also lived in Vienna. He was a correspondent, the Parisian correspondent for the Allgemeine Freie Presse. Yeah. So there is a short story, a short story, written by Altenberg. It's called New Year, 1951 or 41. Anyway, so he describes the New Year Eve. The streets are blanketed with snow, and everybody is rushing. The music plays in the restaurant. He gives him was a very sensitive man. He gives a portrayal of New Year's Eve as a Viennese. I mean, you have to be in Vienna now to understand what it means. You understand? As a Viennese, all the dancers and the prosit-noia, I mean, and kissing each other and embracing each other. And then there's the last line. The same New Year's Eve as I celebrated in 1903. What is the difference? There's one difference only. Peter Altenberg will not be around in 1951 New Year. It means he couldn't imagine how could the New Year's Eve take place without him. And this is typical, I mean, at least I mean, of many individuals. We don't think in such terms, but from time to time thoughts are converge upon us. Converge. And I, of course, I don't think in terms of New Year's Eve. I think in terms of I think the New Year's Eve is, the experience of New Year's Eve is not a part of my, let's say, fond memories. I was once beaten up on New Year's Eve. In Germany, I mean, a German, a fat German, a beer German, met me, Prosit New Year, and he beat me up. It was 1933 or 32. Anyway, but I think many times, you know, when such thoughts come up on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah, I think of another Rosh Hashanah in the future, and I see all the same Rosh, and the same routine, going through the routine, and the chants of the chazan, and the typical melodies, all the call, kukil, the koche, and the shantik, everything as it was. But there's only one difference, I won't be there. And this is a tragic experience. The individual cannot imagine the world without him being around, being a part of it. And this is basically, it's a tragic experience, but it is a creative experience. It's an inspiring experience. I can't explain it to you. But it's an inspiring, and it is rooted in the individuality and exclusiveness of the human being. And that's why when we recite Zichronot al Rosh Hashanah, we speak Ve'lamdin Baal Amdin is Beyomer Ezel Acher Ezel Rov Uvri is Bei Pokedo. The community as well as the individual are judged by the Almighty. He looks upon the single person as a part of a collective, as well as a closed up being, as an open being, in steady communion with the community, I mean with the society, and on the other hand, as a closed up being, separate, abiding in the shadows of community. The same dialectical method, and I want to emphasize that, is applicable to the relationship between the covenantal community, I mean the Jew, and humanity. What's our relationship to mankind? What's our relationship to mankind? Are we a part or aren't we a part of mankind? Anti-Semites now say no. The Jew is not part of mankind. This is the main anti-Semitic story now, which has been circulating for quite a number of years. The Jew is very clannish. He's only concerned with himself. Proof? When the war broke out in Yom Kippur, the Jewish community raised $1 billion in a few days. But did the Jew raise money for Vietnam? Was the Jew concerned with the war in Vietnam? Or was the Jew concerned with the drought-stricken, Africa? He's clannish, he's selfish. Not as an individual, as a group they are selfish. They are group selfish, there is group selfishness. Let's ask ourselves, are we a part or aren't we a part? We are part of mankind because all diseases which attack a non-Jew can attack the Jew as well. Yes, it's same therapy. But experientially, spiritually. Do you belong or don't you belong? I believe the answer lies already in the dialectical method we introduced with regard to the old controversy. What's the relationship between the individual and community? The individual belongs to the community and doesn't belong. He retreats, withdraws from the community, and then he joins the community. The same is true of the covenantal community versus universal community. The covenantal community is also just an individual, an individuality. We certainly share the concerns of man in general, because we face the same problems, such as disease, famine, injustice, etc. But at the same time, we are also concerned, or we are concerned, with ourselves. We have interests and concerns of our own. And one is not supposed to drop our concerns, our individual concerns, because so many of it says that the Jew is egotistic. Again, we are part of humanity, at the same time, we are alone for ourselves. Hence, Judaism has another method by which it sets up a festival and by which it invests or it endows this festival with meaningfulness. It paradoxical is the fact that the Yom Kavua, they called Hanukkah Purim, the Yom Kavua, there is no Kedushas Hayom in those days. But the Yom Kavua, there is something specific, something unique, something singular to the day, that the fact that the Yom Kavua represents philosophically the antithesis of the Sabbath idea. The latter, the Sabbath idea, stresses human liberation from society, human withdrawal from society, a movement of recoil away from society, into one's individuality, into one's home, private home. And Sabbath characterizes, or is representative, of complete immersion of the individual in himself, and consequently, in the Almighty, as a lonely being. Yomim Kvuim emphasized the opposite motive.